The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The big story from Rio this weekend, swimmer Kate Ledecky snagged her first gold at the Games, smashing her own world record for the women's 400 freestyle and obliterating the competition. Just a few days into the Games, attention has already turned from the contaminated water and civil unrest and focused on the athletics themselves. But regardless of how many records Ledecky breaks or how many medals the U.S. takes home, economists agree hosting the Olympics is a costly affair and more often than not leaves cities in the lurch. Megan Greenwell has a potential solution. Why not host the Games in multiple cities at once? Megan is features editor at New York Magazine's The Cut and wrote about her immodest proposal for Wired. Megan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So what exactly do you envision, or how exactly do you envision this idea working? How did the Games get divvied up?
So for context, I should say that most progressive Olympic experts' proposal is to do the opposite of this, to have one permanent host or a couple of cities where it rotates, the idea being to help fix the problem that is the exorbitant costs that cities dole out that often leaves them in the economic lurch. So my idea is to hold one individual Olympics in multiple cities. So you could pick the sport to fit the city based on where they're really interested in that sport or where a lot of the athletes come from or where they already have infrastructure for it. So there's never been an Olympics in Africa, for example, but Kenya could totally host the Olympic marathon. They don't have the infrastructure to host an entire Olympics, but you could put the marathon there and people would line the streets in Nairobi to see this sport that many of their countrymen perform well in, but they ordinarily don't get to see. Hmm. You can put fencing, which is a spectator sport in parts of Europe and basically nowhere else, put it in Italy where it's really popular, put beach volleyball in Rio where there are great beaches, rather than trying to, you know, jerry-rig a particular city to host all of these different sports and creating massive, massive cost problems.
Mm-hmm. Other good ideas. Move swimming to Australia. It's an obsession there. Host soccer in South Africa, where the 2010 World Cup brought them a great deal of pride. So then each country is going to bear the cost of one set of events, right, instead of times a dozen.
Right, and those costs would be much lower anyway because you wouldn't have to build an Olympic village where a million athletes need to stay, for example. There would be few enough athletes that hotels would actually be able to house them. You might have to build one stadium, but if you're only having one event, you might already have that stadium there. Some of the more successful Olympics in recent history have been places where they already have the infrastructure. So Los Angeles was the most successful Olympics economically, and the reason it worked so well was because they already had stadiums. So they didn't have to spend just an obscene amount of money on things they were never going to use again.
I'm trying to imagine this logistically. You've got different time zones. You've got networks needing, just instead of one massive film crew, they need to send out a number to separate cities. So wouldn't it be pretty difficult for the media, for the organizers, and therefore for viewers?
Well, so in the article in Wired, the comparison I brought up was March Madness, the NCAA tournament, which isn't happening in different countries, but it is happening in more than a dozen different sites at once. So CBS sends crews to 13 different cities every year for the early rounds. Those first couple of days, they're just covering game after game after game in different time zones, different cities, et cetera. And they managed to make that work. I talked to a researcher who studies the economics of television at the University of Michigan, a woman named Amanda Lotz, and she said based on how CBS does it for March Madness, it wouldn't be much more of a problem for NBC to cover that number of cities every 4 years.
How much does it cost generally a city to host the Olympics?
So a Summer Olympics typically costs a city between $10 billion and $20 billion, mm-hmm. and they typically generate about between $4 and $5 billion in revenue. So any city is taking a massive, massive hit on this, and many of those cities can afford to take the hit. You know, it wasn't going to bankrupt Beijing, but that does mean that non-premier cities are never going to be able to host an Olympics. And the Olympics are often cited as one of the causes of the massive financial crisis in Greece because Athens took so much of a loss on that. So it really does have a huge negative effect.
I want to go back to this idea that I have heard and you mentioned that we should just have the Olympics in the same city every 4 years from here until eternity. So what is wrong with that idea?
Well, what's wrong with that idea to me is that it does seem a little undemocratic. The Olympics are supposed to be the world's games, but if you're only picking a small set of cities, it's a tiny group of people who are actually going to be able to participate. So about two-thirds of the Olympics ever have been held in Europe, and that would continue because those are the wealthy countries. They'd be held in the U.S., they'd be held in Europe, and maybe occasionally China or an Asian country. You will never see an Olympics in South America. Brazil is actually the first South American Olympics ever. You'll certainly never see one in Africa. You'll never see one in South Asia. So making it such an elite event that only the wealthiest countries can have any involvement with the Olympics seems like the wrong idea to me.
I'm imagining that the new fight is going to be between countries for who gets gymnastics or, you know, who gets the ultra popular sports.
Yeah, for sure. There would definitely be debates over that. And right now, that debate happens during the bidding process, which is incredibly competitive. And countries actually have to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars just to bid. So the cost problems start really, really early in the process.
Yeah,
and so at least if countries are competing over who gets to host an individual event, that might be a spirited debate, but it's not going to contribute to a financial crisis.
Yeah, we actually spoke to a reporter just recently in Chicago and said they are still paying for their Olympic bid.
Yeah.
Well, Megan, it seems like every couple of years, you know, we talk about the terrible economics of the Olympics, and then the games get going, we forget all about it. So do you think that the IOC, it's imperative upon them to make some sort of drastic change? Or is it just as likely that we're going to keep limping along same financially disastrous model for years?
I think the moral obligation is absolutely on the IOC, and I also think that we're going to keep limping along for years. The IOC does not care a whole lot about moral obligations, and the IOC itself is making huge profits off of it. So the problem is that the IOC is basically a greedy, corrupt organization. And realistically, as much as I love my proposal, I don't see that happening, and I don't see anything else happening in the near future to change that.
It's fun to think about, though, isn't it?
Exactly.
Megan Greenwell, she's features editor at New York Magazine's The Cut. She's also a contributor to Wired, and that's why that's where you'll find her article. Here's an idea. Hold the Olympics in multiple cities at once. There's a link to read it at wordofmouthradio.org. Last week, we spent some time speaking with Reeves Wideman, who wrote about Olympic archery for Harper's. He told us that partly because of characters like the Hunger Games' Katniss Everdeen and Hawkeye from The Avengers, archery is kind of in right now.
Compared to some of the other fringe sports, archery has sort of developed something of a following. That said, it's not the most thrilling sport to watch. You're basically just kind of watching an archer stand still and then release their bow, and then a second later it either hits the target or it doesn't. And that's basically it.
So if we followed Megan's advice and divvied up the Olympics, holding the marathon in Kenya, fencing in Italy, and beach volleyball in Rio, where would we hold archery events? District 12? Maybe the birthplace of William Tell or Sherwood Forest? Wherever it lands, I did get a chance to catch up on some of the archery events this morning, and I've got to say, it may not be as thrilling as a swim race, but it does help to have an enthusiastic announcer doing play-by-play.
To try and apply the pressure, wind picks up. One arrow. Oh, he's done it! What a shot!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Do you have a ratty old sweater that speaks to you? I mean, really, when you pick it up, does a tiny voice in your head plead, "Keep me"? Fans of Marie Kondo's mega-selling book, The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, take a rigorous approach to organization. Keep only the things that spark joy. The movement proposes that letting go of material clutter makes room for a healthier, more fulfilled life. In a New York Times op-ed, Stephanie Land says the popular self-help program is for those who can afford excess. She's a freelance writer and author and joins us for more on the class politics of decluttering. And Stephanie, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Marie Kondo's book on tidying up shot to the top of the bestsellers list, as has her follow-up book. There are countless videos online showing you how to fold things in the Marie Kondo way. Why do you think this so appealed to people?
I think people maybe feel a little bit out of control for various reasons. And so when someone comes along and says, "I can help you simplify your life and all you have to do is fold clothes differently," you know, people grasp onto that.
It is proposed as a kind of unburdening, that the less stuff you have, the more virtuous you are. Now, you find that to be a privileged view. Why?
Yeah, I find it very privileged. I mean, even when you're talking about it, I have a hard time understanding why it would be helpful to me. I've always had just enough stuff that I could have that was necessary, and I couldn't afford to get anything else. But I also couldn't afford to get rid of things because I might need them in the future. So I've kind of always been a minimalist by nature, but it was not because of any virtue. It was just because of my economic status.
Hmm.
You know, even as I have been making more money in the last year, I have been getting rid of a lot of stuff. But it's still a stress to me. Like, I have to constantly remind myself, if I end up needing this later, I can pay to replace it. Like, I can buy it. So I think that's a huge aspect to the minimalism thing, is if you whittle all of your stuff down to 100 things, or, you know, however many they have, if you suddenly remember, like, oh man, I got rid of that wok pan and I need that for tonight, I'm having people over, they can go out and buy one. And people in poverty, they don't have that option at all.
If you have excess, if you have too much stuff clouding you, you're not going to be happy. I mean, doesn't that make sense, even if you are just struggling to get by?
I think so. But I'm not going to judge someone who isn't bothered by that. You know, there are some people who aren't mentally bogged down by a lot of clutter in their house. That is the way that they live, and that is how they like their house to be.
Well, you do write in your piece that you hunt for the deal. You hurry to Walmart for sales. Do you feel judged for that by the minimalist movement?
I don't hurry in the sense of like Black Friday or, but you know, I know when the seasons change, Walmart usually has a lot of clothes on clearance, and I feel horrible because a lot of my friends, especially in, I live in kind of a liberal town, and I've had many conversations with people who just scoff at Walmart and hate it. And I've watched all the documentaries. I know how horrible Walmart is, and I still can't afford to even go to Goodwill, because you go to Goodwill and shirts for kids are $4 or $5 sometimes. Where I can go to Walmart and get a shirt on clearance for a dollar.
Well, minimalist logic says having less makes you happier. Now, you wrote about your experience as a single mom, putting yourself through college, working cleaning people's houses. What did you observe about people who were your clients' relationship to stuff?
It seemed to me that, I'm being general here, but many of my clients worked a lot. And I saw a lot of evidence that that possibly stressed them out. They lined up in their bathrooms. They had sleep aids and painkillers and, you know, medication for anxiety and stress. Whereas I thought that once you had the house and you had the nice car and you had the stuff to go with it, that meant happiness. And I was really surprised to find out and disenchanted, really, that wasn't the case, that they were just as unhappy as the rest of us without any money or a nice house.
Stephanie Land, she's a writing fellow at the Center for Community Change and wrote an op-ed in the New York Times called The Class Politics of Decluttering. Stephanie, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
You can find a link to read her article at wordofmouthradio.org. In most places, alleys are forgotten places by citizens, architects, and planners. The word alone conjures images of garbage, darkness, or dead ends in chase scenes on movie and TV. Certainly not communal spaces. But in cities around the world where space is tight and expensive, alleys are becoming paths to a more pedestrian lifestyle, the site of new retail hubs, even parks. Eileen Anzalotti joins us from the Atlantic's City Lab to talk about how these narrow, blighted spaces are now being transformed. And Eileen, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Glad to be here.
Eileen, if you add up all of the acreage in cities, alleys count for a lot. Have they always been considered these no-go zones?
Well, in the United States, at least, they were always sort of, you know, an important infrastructural element. So they were kind of like the service entrance to buildings. And, you know, there were places where trash collection happened and loading docks for construction. It was all these kind of things that, you know, everyday passerby would just kind of overlook. But now the landscape of cities is changing. And I think a lot of places are just sort of starting to reassess, you know, like space is becoming cramped, and these are obviously huge networks. So, I mean, I think if you take Seattle, for instance, they kind of took a look at, you know, the amount of space that these alleys were taking up and realized that if they were to convert them to viable public space, they could double that number in the city by 50%. So that's pretty mind-blowing.
Can they all be reinvigorated, though? Aren't most already being used, as you said, you know, supporting delivery or trash or storage for surrounding buildings or even dead ends?
Right. Well, there are obviously these elements that are still in play. But I think, you know, again, looking at Seattle, a lot of cities are also sort of reimagining those systems that kind of made alleys necessary. So Seattle, for instance, transitioned from a dumpster system to bag collection for trash. So that sort of rendered, you know, the alley's function in that regard a little bit obsolete. And then they were just kind of becoming these places that were just untended and sort of useless in their old concept. So I think there is something to be said for cities to kind of take stock of where they're at with all of these old systems and seeing how everything is evolving and thinking like maybe we don't need all of this extra space for these sort of systems that are becoming more and more obsolete.
So besides Seattle, what are other examples of how alleys are being transformed into more welcoming and even greener, as you point out in your article, spaces?
Yeah, well, I think Chicago really kind of led the charge in terms of the green alleyway system because, you know, the issue there is Chicago is notorious for having just a massive alleyway system. It's one of the most extensive in the country. But they kind of realized that flooding was becoming a huge issue. So one of the things that Chicago has done is transitioned a lot of their alleyways, repaved them with more permeable substances, and are kind of moving them toward the system that they actually call green alleyways. And it's alleviating a lot of the burden on the city's sewer system. So that's definitely been a positive for Chicago. And another city that I really like what they're doing with the alleys is Baltimore, because trash collection in the waterways of that city was becoming a huge issue. And to address that, the organizers of the whole waterfront initiative looked to kind of see the origins, and they realized it was piling up in alleyways. So instead of just saying, you know, we need to clean these up, they were like, why don't we get the community involved, and turned, you know, it into a sort of like reinvigorating project where neighbors came together and reimagined alleys and turned them into these artistic, you know, sort of communal spaces.
I'm glad you mentioned Baltimore because, of course, places like Kyoto and Melbourne, which you point out, they're getting new life as retail spaces and alleyways. But in these less moneyed or touristed places, How are they, for one, paying for this kind of transformation of alleyways?
Well, Baltimore actually received a grant. So it was $30,000 and it was kind of distributed, you know, as needed. So, but the point about alley revitalization is it really doesn't have to be this massively expensive thing. A lot of the times it's just actually just takes sort of facing the spaces and saying, like, you know, we've let these slide, and a lot of times it just has to do with cleanup. And, you know, in Baltimore, some of the revitalization is really just as simple as getting people together for an afternoon and having them paint a mural. And all of a sudden, that sort of makes people rethink, you know, what these spaces can be and who can go there and kind of what they can be used for. So now they've become, you know, people can have block parties in the alleys too. And it's just that didn't even take a lot of money. So I think it's just really incredible to see how these tiny little spaces can transform with, you know, almost no budget.
Well, Eileen, thank you for giving us a new view of the alleyway.
Well, thank you. I mean, I could talk about it forever. I think it's a really great plan for cities.
Eileen Anzalotti is an editorial fellow at City Lab, and you'll find a link to see her piece, A New Life for Urban Alleys. The link is at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The dog days of summer have arrived, and as we near mid-August, perhaps you're nearing the end of your summer reading list. For those looking for new titles to bring to the beach, we've got you covered. Here with a list of best overlooked books to add to your summer reading list are Michelle Philgate. She's contributing editor at Literary Hub and board member of the National Book Critics Circle. Michelle, great to have you back with us.
It's always great to be here, Virginia.
Also, Isaac Fitzgerald. He's books editor for BuzzFeed. Hello, Isaac. Welcome back.
Hi, Virginia. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start with you, Isaac. What tops your list for the best overlooked summer reading book?
All right. So I feel like, and Michelle's going to say this too, but I want to start out by saying these are books that I love that I feel like aren't getting enough attention, but I don't want to call them overlooked because it's not like they're sitting in dusty corners ignored. These are books that are very, very wonderful, and they've grabbed certain people's attention, but my hope is to bring them to even wider audiences.
So they're not orphans, but they're not Daniel Silva.
Yeah, you know, they're not exactly tap dancing, getting parades thrown for them, but God, they're good and they deserve it. They deserve the parades, Virginia. So first up is Homegoing by Yaa Jesse. It's her debut novel, and it has this just really cool, like this riveting structure where it follows two half-sisters in 18th century Ghana and the lives of their children and then their children's children and then their children's children and so on. One sister is kidnapped and sold into slavery in America, while the other, the wife of a slave dealer, remains in Africa. And so, like I said, each chapter follows a new generation of their descendants, and that really makes you feel the passage of time and the different way these lives kind of separate. It's a beautiful book.
That's actually on my book lust list. I've heard a
yes.
lot about it from a lot of people.
Now,
Michelle, we got a list from you, and you only included two novels, which may or may not be unusual for you. I know you have a wide variety. So let's start with the novels. Which did you choose?
Yeah, like Isaac, these books that I've chosen, you know, they have gotten critical attention, and I just believe that they deserve all the attention. So the first book I want to talk about is The Sport of Kings by C.E. Morgan, which has gotten acclaim from two of my favorite critics, Dwight Garner at The New York Times and Catherine Schultz of The New Yorker. The Sport of Kings is this epic, great American novel. It's really one of the most ambitious books I've read recently. It's set in Kentucky. It follows the Forge family over multiple generations. And it's also about horse racing. Henry Forge, the patriarch, decides to turn his family's farm into a horse racing farm. But it's also very, very much about a topic that is something we need to address constantly, especially lately, which is racism. And that explores it in a very nuanced way in this book. I also, you know, as I've said before on this show, I'm a huge fan of sentences, mostly more than plot. And this book, just the sentences are like a fever dream. The prose is incandescent. It's gorgeous.
What else you got? Problems by Jade Sharma.
Yeah, so Problems by Jade Sharma. I just interviewed her for the Los Angeles Times. It was published by Emily Gould's publishing company called Emily Books. I'm a huge fan of what she chooses to publish with, along with Ruth Curry, her co-publisher. This is a book about Maya, who is a heroin addict. And she's in a failing marriage. She's also in a failing affair. And she's just kind of going through the motions in her life. I love how raw this book is. It's very stream of consciousness, and it's told with a mordant sense of humor, too.
It sounds really timely, both of them in their own way, heroin addiction and also racism. But Isaac, now you chose a novel before about 18th century Ghana. What else have you got for us? Maybe something a little more contemporary?
Yeah, I can. Well, and just so you know, that other book does move through time. But yes, I can bring you right up almost to present day, which is Private Citizens by Tony Tulitamudi. And as we're talking about things getting critical acclaim, the book, the person that's championing this book quite a bit is Jonathan Franzen. And he actually doesn't come out to really talk about books that often these days. So it's been really interesting to watch him mention this book time and time again. So Tony's book, it's Tony Tulitamudi. It's his debut novel as well. It's about four post-college friends stumbling along and screwing up in late 2000s San Francisco. So a very modern book. And it's, you know, I'm a little partial to this book myself because I spent time in San Francisco. So I really enjoyed reading about it. But I feel like anyone from anywhere in the country kind of interested in today's youth and youth culture can appreciate this book. The characters are something, they're incredibly smart, and they sometimes get in their own way. But I can say this about Tony Tulitamudi's writing. It is also incredibly smart, but he never gets in his own way. He's entertaining and he's insightful. It's just really, if you're a sentence person, I think you'd really enjoy it, Michelle.
Okay. Awesome.
You also recommended a book that is set in India. We interviewed previously the author of this, Karan Mahajan. This is The Association of Small Bombs. Tell us why you liked it.
Man, I just love this book so, so much. And I'm so glad to hear that you had him on this show because he is such a wonderful, terrific writer. I feel like one of the best young writers out there today. And the Association of Small Bombs, it examines an act of terrorism in a way that feels both panoramic and personal. There's, as you know, there's this bomb. It explodes in the Delhi marketplace. And we follow a boy who survived the explosion and the family of these boys who did not. The novel, so it's very nuanced. Like, what I really loved about it is the way that it just deals and dives into grief and what it is to feel guilt. And the ways in which violence kind of can flower and set off other chain reactions or association of small bombs. And it takes us through a really empathetic way of looking at how a terrorist could come to be radicalized.
Yeah, I loved that also, you know, this whole notion of a small bomb. You know, we hear about these huge explosions, but small ones happen every day all over the world, or almost every day all over the world, and they're not examined in the same way. I really liked that he was picking that up.
Absolutely.
Michelle, you recommended a couple of memoirs, one of them set right here in New Hampshire.
Absolutely.
Ooh, good
yeah.
choice.
So the Penny Poet of Portsmouth by my friend Catherine Towler, I would pick this book even if she wasn't a good friend of mine. This is just a gorgeous meditation on what it is to be a writer and the life of a writer. It's about her friendship with Robert Dunn, who was the poet laureate of Portsmouth from 1999 to 2001. And towards the end of his life, he passed away when he was 65. Catherine became his caretaker. She became his close confidant, his friend. And this was a man who was deeply private, who was much beloved in the community. He was known for selling books of his poems on the streets of Portsmouth for a penny a piece. And he was very content with being a minor poet. He didn't care for fame and fortune, which is a good thing because most poets don't have that.
But well, I'm happy to say that we also interviewed Catherine on this program.
I'm so glad. Catherine's just an incredible writer, and this book is just a very good examination of both what the solitude required for a writing life and the community that you need to draw from as well.
Solitude comes up again in Olivia Lang's memoir, The Lonely City.
Yes, so I'm a big fan of her writing. She is really great at taking cultural criticism and her own personal story and blending it together. And if you couldn't tell, I have a theme here of loneliness in some of my books. I don't know what that says about me, except that I really do like reading about that. So Olivia's book is set in New York, and it focuses on artists who explore loneliness in their own work. So she talks a lot about Andy Warhol and Edward Hopper and her own experience living in New York for a while. At one point in the book, she says something that really resonated with me that I quoted in an essay I wrote for Lit Hub on loneliness. She said, "Loneliness feels like such a shameful experience, so counter to the lives we are supposed to lead, that it becomes increasingly inadmissible, a taboo state whose confession seems destined to cause others to turn and flee." Hmm. And I really love that. And what I think about that is, what if we don't flee? What if we listen to that sentiment?
That's Michelle Philgate. She's with us along with Isaac Fitzgerald, sharing some of their recommendations for some of the books that, all right, let's revise this, did not get as much attention as they think they should have this summer. How's that for you guys?
Absolutely. Yeah. Every one of these books should have been on the cover of the New York Times.
Okay. Isaac, what else is on your list?
So I've got Here Comes the Sun by Nicole Dennis Benn. It delves into the complex lives of three women residing near a resort on Montego Bay, Jamaica. This book, it's beautiful, it's devastating, and it's this exploration of love, what we do for family and familial love, what we do in the name of romantic love, and the ways in which communities can crush that love. Mm-hmm. These three characters, they struggle with a lot, and Dennis Benn, like, she writes them so amazingly well as these living, breathing people. There's so much more than a sum of their issues. And one of the other reasons why I think this is just a great book to fit in before the end of summer is that this book really does kind of look at the ways where places that where a lot of people feel like they're just going as vacation and they're going as tourists, the way in which that can kind of affect people that actually live and come from and have roots in those areas.
How about you, Michelle? What is it that makes for a good summer read for you?
For me, it's the ability to feel like I'm not in New York City where I live, something that makes me escape. So it doesn't always have to be light reading. I actually prefer darker reading in the summer. My last pick here is a book that just came out, so it hasn't even had time to get the buzz that it deserves. But it's Nadia Spiegelman, the daughter of the famous graphic novelist Art Spiegelman. Hmm. And it's her memoir called I'm Supposed to Protect You from All This. What this book does is really goes into the process of writing memoir in a way that's just beautiful. It's all about stories and being in control of the stories that you're told and being the narrator of your own life. So she started interviewing her mother, who is the art director of The New Yorker and the publisher of Toon Books. When she was in college, she decided she wanted to start talking to her mother about her mother's life. And then she decided to start talking to her grandmother, who lives in Paris, who she wasn't close with at the time. And through their stories, you know, they would sometimes tell different versions of the same stories. She creates this remarkable narrative. And she also weaves in her own story now as a new generation of this family. So it's also about, what it is to be a woman in a family.
Okay, Michelle, you said that you like dark books in the summer. When do you not like dark books?
That's true. I like them all the time.
Isaac, how about for you? What makes a good summer read for you?
Good one, Virginia. First off and foremost, I really enjoyed that. For me, it's really about the same as what Michelle's saying, this ability to escape. But for me, I also really like big books in the summer. I feel like it's when I can just really tackle a giant tome that I maybe have had a hard time making time for. But I'm also going to back up what Michelle's saying about kind of darker reads, because I actually do find myself leaning towards the lighter in winter, because I need to remember. I need to know that there's light at the end of the tunnel. But in summer, it's almost when I feel like I have more room, more ability to move, where I can tackle a larger book that might be a little intimidating in another season.
Well, Isaac, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Isaac Fitzgerald, books editor for BuzzFeed and co-founder of Pen and Ink. That's a Tumblr of tattoos and the stories behind them. And Michelle, great to have you with us as always.
Thanks for having me.
Michelle Philgate, she's a writer and contributing editor at Literary Hub and board member of the National Book Critics Circle. And we want to let you know that we will have a list of all of the books deserving of more attention that Michelle and Isaac shared with us at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you've ever visited Prescott Park in Portsmouth, maybe you've walked out to the pier overlooking the Piscataqua River and seen a plaque that says, "From here you can see the tide turn like a door on its hinges."
From here you can see the tide turn like a door on its hinges. We're just going out. Do you want anything from the ocean?
That's the voice of Robert Dunn reading his poem, From Here You Can See. Dunn was Portsmouth's poet laureate from 1999 to 2001, and he was both a fixture and an enigma, often seen walking the streets of the rough-edged town, long before Starbucks and the gift shops took up residence, or the New York Times praised its absurd selection of restaurants and cafes. The writer Catherine Towler moved to Portsmouth at the onset of that boom and was intrigued by Dunn, living in a single room without an electrical outlet and selling his hand-bound poetry collections for a penny. Her new book, The Penny Poet of Portsmouth, recounts their unfolding relationship as her life and the seaside town transformed. And Catherine Towler, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia. It's good to be here.
So you first saw Robert Dunn there, kind of shambling along the streets, brushing by you with barely an acknowledgement at one point. You assumed he was homeless, but he wasn't. Who was he, and how did he live?
So Robert was a poet, and that was the primary focus of his life, was his writing. And he read a great deal. He was one of the most widely read people I have ever met. And he worked a few hours each afternoon at the Portsmouth Athenaeum. And, well, I saw him first on the streets when I moved to Portsmouth, as you describe, and then I met him as my neighbor. I discovered that he lived next door to me, where he had the single room in the house he rented. And through meeting him as my neighbor and then also as a fellow writer, that I got to know him a little bit. He was a hard person to get to know.
This is a man who never appeared to need friends. I mean, certainly didn't want charity from anybody or even health insurance from his employers at the Athenaeum. But he was a heavy smoker, had some pulmonary troubles, emphysema. And this failing health kind of increased this vulnerability that vanished, that careful distance he had. I think you call it the silent insistence that the world came to him. There's a real power in that, isn't there, in that kind of remove?
Oh, sure. There's a great power in it. And Robert sort of dictated the terms on which he would open up to people, and he dictated the terms in which he would share his writing. So he was not like many writers looking for fame. He did not care that much about how his work was published. He wanted to connect with readers. And so he did remain an enigmatic person, and there is a sort of power in that, you know? He controlled how people knew him and what they knew about him.
That kind of leads us to another, I think, really powerful theme in the book. There's this tension in your own life as you tried to stick to your writing while now married, you know, learning how to be married, now a member of a community. Could you read a bit from the book about that?
Well, this is from chapter 11, and it's after Robert has become sick, and so he's not able to walk around town as much. And at the beginning of this chapter, I'm walking into town on a December evening, and I'm thinking about how Robert is missing on the streets of Portsmouth and how I am missing seeing him there. There's an irony in our looking to someone like Robert, who deliberately defined himself outside the mainstream of human life, to tell us about the living of that life. This person watching from the sidelines should, it seems, be the least qualified to illuminate our experience, but this is what we ask of writers. The ones who produce the most lasting books are often ruthless at separating themselves from the world. In this riddle lies the uncertainty at the heart of the writer's work. We have no right to make claims for the rest of our human brothers and sisters, but this is precisely what we do. We plant a flag at the summit of human experience. We assert that though we might be quiet, watchful types prone to lurking in corners, We have some insight into the lives of our more active neighbors that gives us the license to tell their stories. Solitude is not a recipe by itself for good writing, nor does good writing necessarily require solitude. But often when these elements come together at the highest levels, something sublime occurs. Robert is a good example. He was beloved as a poet among those who knew his work in New Hampshire and beyond because he had his finger on the pulse of a few significant truths and translated them into language that, though the voice might have been quirky and unpredictable, was instantly recognizable as our own common language. He stood outside the world while giving it back to us whole.
That's Catherine Towler reading from The Penny Poet of Portsmouth. This is her memoir, charting her unfolding relationship with the poet Robert Dunn. It's an elegy of sorts to an eccentric poet and for the town, which inspired and ultimately took care of him. He died in 2008. Well, Robert was reclusive, seemed not to care about the success and the recognition and the material trappings of fame, which made you, you're writing and publishing three novels, you're going out on book tours, feel somewhat suspect in his eyes. Now, what did that mean for you?
He was a challenge. You know, the way Robert lived his life with such incredible integrity was a challenge, I think, to anyone, but particularly to me as a writer. He made me think about what was most important and why was I writing? What was it I most wanted? So did fame come first or did the writing come first? He put the writing first. He wasn't doing it to get recognition from others. He was doing it for the pure art of it. And that was why I felt sometimes that he was observing me and how caught up I was in caring about what others thought of my writing and trying to, you know, impress other people with my work instead of simply focusing on the work itself and doing the work that I needed to be doing without thought of how it would be received.
But it seems like you observed a cost in being that single-minded about your work, too.
I did. So for me, the process of writing the book was coming to understand my own admiration for Robert. I had admired him so much in the first years when I knew him, and I held him up as an ideal. But when he became sick, I saw the cost of that kind of single-minded devotion. I saw the cost of how he had lived financially on so little. He did not have a family. He did not have a partner. And he was very alone at the end of his life, at a time when he needed other people. And so it made me reevaluate my admiration of him and think about that ideal of, you know, the single-minded devotion to your art. And it made me appreciate perhaps the more complex nature of my life, the fact that I had gotten married and had a life that was more full of people than his life.
That was my earlier conversation with Catherine Towler, author most recently of the memoir, The Penny Poet of Portsmouth. You'll find a link for more on the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And for our last word today, what to do with all of that floss? Last week, we spoke to the AP reporter who found no conclusive evidence that flossing improves health. If comedian Mitch Hedberg were still alive, he would be among those rejoicing.
I can't get into the flossing thing. People who smoke cigarettes, they say, man, you don't know how hard it is to quit smoking. Yes, I do. It's as hard as it is to start flossing. You seem jittery. Yeah, I'm about to floss.
Well, what to do with all of that accumulated floss? Daniel Victor pulled together some MacGyvery floss advice from survivalists, crafters, and convicted felons for the New York Times. You can, for example, cut cake or fashion a fishing line if you land on a desert island or make shoelaces. Another combined floss with toothpaste to saw his way out of his cell. And in 2012, escapees used it to sew up a gunshot wound. It's no wonder that so many prisons have switched to floss sticks. And we welcome your thoughts on what to do with those. I'm Virginia Prescott, back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue, Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.